But now, Sir Arnold Wesker can feel more included than ever with recent revivals of his most celebrated works. BBC Radio 3 brings you an exclusive interview with Wesker in the Sunday feature.
And she said, "It's good. I'm not saying it's not good, but who's going to be interested in any of that?"
And following it, one of those revivals transfers to radio. His first play, Chicken Soup with Barley, in the Royal Court's sold-out recent production, capturing the collapse of an ideology and the disintegration of a family.
"The great ideal you always cherished has exploded in front of your eyes, but you won't face it."
Wesker on BBC Radio 3. Drama on 3 and the Sunday feature, starting at 7:45.
And that's this evening. This is BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's now 12 midday. Time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Tessa Hadley has received fulsome praise for her four novels, the first of which was Accidents in the Home and the most recent, The London Train. She's also published two collections of short stories, and I'm currently enjoying the most recent, Married Love, which came out in January of this year. It contains a composer and many references to music, from which I rather gather, Tessa, that music is something of a passion for you.
It is, and it's been around me from the beginning of my life, mainly through my father, who's intensely musical and loves music. I'm not an expert in music in any way, and it's been very interesting thinking about doing the programme to actually imagine myself articulating what I like. It mostly happens in a different place to where I love books, which I talk about readily and all the time.
You said that music was all around you, and I think the first piece that you've chosen goes back to Cambridge when you were about 20.
That's right, and I just knew nothing about opera at all, and I can't even remember how I stumbled along, alone, I know, to see L'Incoronazione di Poppea, Monteverdi, with no idea what I was going to or what it meant or what it was, and having this transfiguring experience listening to that exquisite final aria where Nero crowns Poppea. And after all the trumpets have sounded and all the authorities and dignitaries have sort of done the formalities of the occasion, the two lovers address each other as if they were alone in a room with this kind of intimacy and amazing mutuality, because they're both sung by women. So there's an extraordinary balance.
Entwining of voices, don't you? Which you also get later in Strauss at the end of Rosenkavalier, for example. But this is sensuous to the point of eroticism, don't you think?
Astonishing. It just ambushed me. And I had a very uncharacteristic thought at that moment, which isn't what I usually think. I thought, this is more beautiful than anything in life could ever be. Now, normally I'm the sort of reader and the sort of listener who thinks, that's lovely because it's like what really happens. I just thought, this is better. This is something else. And it stayed with me forever, so I had to have it.
Thank you.
Porti Miro, Porti Godo, the final duet from Incoronazione di Poppea by Monteverdi. We heard Helen Donat singing Poppea and Elizabeth Söderström, Nero, with Concertus Musicus, Vienna, directed by Nikolaus Arnoncourt. You mentioned when we started talking, Tessa Hadley, your father.
Hmm.
And I think we're going to hear him in action now.
Yes, I've chosen one of Dad's pieces, which is both something he's playing with the marvellous jazz band that he played with for 50 years, the Avon Cities, Bristol Jazz Band. And it's also something he composed. He wrote always for that band, more and more ambitiously and creatively and excitingly. And then since he retired from the other parts of his work, he was a school teacher first and a shopkeeper, he's also been writing classical music, written some beautiful settings for Thomas Hardy poems and things. Probably my dad has been the model. I haven't followed him musically, but I've always known you could dedicate yourself to something, that you could just obsess about it and shut yourself off from the other demands of life, the washing up, the jobs to be done, and submerge yourself in work, delicious work.
So that was Jeff Nichols and Hulo with the Avon Cities Jazz Band, or maybe it's Hulo.
Hulo, correct, yeah. I suppose.
The name Nichols rings a bell. It's not by any chance related to a previous guest on this programme.
Peter Nichols, my uncle, the playwright, who I think also chose a track from my dad's jazz. So Dad's been insinuating his music into both our lives. Jazz feels like home to me. I always have this warm feeling that I'm re-entering a sort of primal place with lovely mainstream jazz.
You did have piano lessons when you were a child, Tessa Hadley.
Well, I did, but I had no talent and I was naughty about practising. But exciting, fun to do.
And did you find, like I did, that it was really quite nice to get away from little, slightly fey Austrian waltzes and to get into some Bartok, even if just simply Microcosmos?
Yes, I love the abrasiveness and the rhythmicness of the Bartok, and I still have those Microcosmos and I can still play a few of them very badly, but yeah.
But in fact, it's actually some of the Romanian dances you've opted for,
yes.
Played wonderfully, I might say, by Zoltán Kocsis. What do you like about these?
I suppose it's that Eastern European thing that Bartok, among others, but Bartok especially with his fascination for folk music, seems to bring into the mainstream European tradition something violent and abrasive and not polite, something quite apart from the great traditions of high European culture. And suddenly there's this gritty, gypsy wildness. That sounds romantic, and actually it isn't romantic. It's fierce, this thing that Bartok injects into European tradition, and it feels very appropriate to what's going on all around him in the mid-20th century.
Music by Bartok from his Romanian folk dances, played by Zoltán Kocsis. You refer to Bluebeard's castle in Married Love, don't you? And actually, I think what you refer to there is the feeling of a young wife, of all of those rooms with danger behind each door.
I'd been to see, maybe a year or two before I wrote that story, maybe closer, a wonderful Welsh National Opera production of Bluebeard's Castle in Cardiff, and it had staged that marvellously, those eerie succession of spaces around the stage that felt like metaphorical spaces, yes, for discovery in a marriage. I suppose this is the other aspect of that mutuality we were talking about in relation to the Monteverdi. Take the erotic past its exquisite moment of togetherness, and that's what you're talking about, this dangerous saga between two people where one opens one door after another door after another door and finds frightening things.
We're going to hear now a piece which I think you would find impossible to omit for various reasons.
This is the Schubert slow movement from the E-flat trio, which I don't know why, it's just been the piece for me from when I first heard it. I don't know when that was. I love chamber music, so we go to listen to a lot of that in Cardiff, and I've heard this often. And actually, I introduced my younger son to this as well, and it's also become his favourite piece. What is it about it? The yearning, the intimacy of chamber music. I think I love that because of books. It's funny, there seems to me something about chamber music which is more like the domesticity of novels and short stories than symphonic music, which is more public somehow. So the closeness of this music appeals to me, and it always seems to me very, very melancholic. Schubert, more than anybody else, makes me think about dead young people, and that's not just a romantic thing attached to him because he died young. He catches what almost sounds like popular music, the strains of little songs, little bits of nothing, and makes them haunting, as if the people who enjoyed them have gone from the stage and just the music's left. And I suppose that is terribly romantic, but my goodness, he can do that with all the weight of the truth that that's what happens, and we all die, and then music and books are left behind us.
Thank you.
You can hear Schubert, the songwriter, in there, can't you?
I love the songs and would have chosen one if there were world enough and time, yes.
Well, instead we had music from the Piano Trio No. 2 in E-flat, Deutsch 929, the second movement, Andante con moto, played by Les Musiciens. Tessa Hadley, we're going to hear some pop music in a moment, but first I just wanted to ask you, whether you feel sometimes that, I mean, for example, in a piece like that, Schubert doesn't have to give too much of himself. Well, of course, he gives a lot of himself. He doesn't give the precise reasoning behind it. Whereas a novelist, you have to use words, and therefore there's a degree of what might be autobiographical, but, or at least in as much as it certainly comes from experience.
Yes, it's because it commits one. You're right, there's a literalism that is just built into language. That language is literal. It says things, it describes things, it says one thing rather than another. And one's always stealing oneself and then wincing. Actually, it's funny business writing, and it's full of shame. I've talked about this with my writing students sometimes. If you don't wince your way through what you write, you won't be a good writer, I suspect. You should feel all the time, how could I have said that? Am I sure? What do I think I'm doing? Yes, there is. There's this putting yourself out there, which doesn't have that much to do with being autobiographical, actually. I think it's more fundamental than that.
Talking of words, and as I mentioned, pop music, it's Bob Dylan next.
There's a whole world of different pop musics that I love and that have meant so much to me, and I sort of needed to choose one thing to stand for all that, which is impossible. So I chose something that seems so tiny. It's just an exquisite bit of early Dylan sounding like a songmaker in the great tradition that's Thomas Wyatt and Dowland and Burns and all those lovers who've deceived us by writing these utterly, utterly seductive, charming little songs. And they're quite cruel. This is a cruel song, this one, really, I think. Don't go shining your light, babe, I'm on the wrong side of the road. Why do girls love it? But they do.
And you followed his advice by taking it, don't think twice, it's all right.
Yes, exactly.
Well, it ain't no use sitting and wonder why, baby, even you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, it'll never do somehow. when your rooster crows at the break of dawn. Look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm a-traveling on. But don't think twice, it's all right. And it ain't no use in turning on your light, babe. The light I never knowed. And it ain't no use in turning on your light, babe. I'm on the dark side of the road. But I wish there was something you would do or say to try and make me change my mind and stay. But we never did too much talking anyway. But don't think twice, it's all right. And calling out my name, gal, like you never done before. And it ain't no use in calling out my name, gal, I can't hear you anymore. I'm a-thinking and a-wondering, walking down the road. I once loved a woman, a child, I'm told. I give her my heart, but she wanted my soul. Don't think twice, it's all right. So long, honey, baby, where I'm bound, I can't tell. Goodbye is too good a word, baby. So I just say fairly well. I ain't saying you treated me unkind. You could have done better, but I don't mind. You just kind of wasted my precious time. But don't think twice, it's all right.
Don't think twice, it's all right. From the freewheeling Bob Dylan. Tessa Hadley, I'm going to ask you in a minute to read a little extract from the conclusion of the first story in Married Love, because I think it would go very nicely into a bit of Strauss's Metamorphosen. So let's talk about that first. This is a piece which always seems to me looks back at a disappearing epoch with sadness.
With sadness and something worse than sadness. I mean, to be writing this in 1945, it's as if that great movement of music and light and that adventure of the spirit that's represented by everything that's from the Enlightenment, from the great musics of the classical era, it's led to this horror. And somewhere Strauss is in that, dirtied in it, and there's something in the music, the actual notes of the music to my ear, which keep trying to soar and then being dragged back down. There is no resolve, there's no resolution to this.
And of course, I think it was also shortly after the bombing of Dresden, which had a devastating effect on Strauss.
Yes, one feels that probably superficially the music is as elegiac for the Germany in ruins around him as anything else. That's the prompt. But because he's a great composer, he trawls his net and it becomes an elegy for everything that Europe had believed about itself that had just ended in filthy smoke. It's a terrible piece of music, actually.
I thought that the conclusion of this first story from Married Love would be good because it's about a composer. Actually, it's about a young girl, Lottie, who announces to her rather appalled family that she's fallen in love with a tutor many decades older than her and is going to marry him. And three children emerge very quickly, and very soon she cuts her hair off with her own scissors and wears baggy clothes, and the composing tutor ages and she can think of nothing but money and nappies. And it's rather bleak, the end, in a way. And I thought if you could just give us this description of where she is drinking with her brother and he comes in.
"We're finishing up that Bacardi, Ed," Lottie said, enunciating too carefully. "Do you want some?" Edgar's eyes these days had retreated behind his jutting cheekbones and sprouting eyebrows. Something suave had gone out of his manner. He said that he would rather have a hot drink. Forgetfully, he waited, as if he expected Lottie to jump up and make it for him. When he remembered after a moment and went into the kitchen to do it himself, he didn't imply the least reproach. He was merely absorbed, as if his thoughts were elsewhere. Noah saw how hungrily from where she lay Lottie followed the ordinary kitchen music. The crescendo of the kettle, the chatter of crockery, the punctuation of cupboard doors, the chiming of the spoon in the cup. As if she might hear in it something that was meant for her.
part of Metamorphosen by Richard Strauss, played by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Mozart next to Sir Hadley, and indeed opera.
Somehow not surprising that novelists, short story writers, love these Mozart operas, which seem to be the place where culture discovers the domestic, the intimate, the family, with all the comedy of human interaction, is not a small or a minor thing, but it's big, huge, central. You can be funny about it and eloquent and poignant at once. That's what I love about all the Mozart operas. And I feel this one is just as familial, actually, as The Marriage of Figaro, Così fan tutte, even though it ostensibly has a slightly sort of grander shape to it, but it still feels like a family, half at war, half in love.
It's Shakespearean in its remit, really, and in the way that it manages to portray and comment on human frailty.
Yes, and everybody's mixed. Nobody has the tune that says, I'm right, here, I win. And in fact, it was so hard to choose the right aria from Don Giovanni, which is my favourite. I love the purely erotic. I love La ci darem la mano, which Zelina and the Don sing together. But I thought we've had the purely erotic. We've had Monteverdi. That's enough of the erotic for today. And then there's the wonderful emotionalism, and if you like, the good story of Donna Anna and Don Ottavio, and they sing their lovely aria where they say, my happiness depends on you. Although when you look at that closely, you do wonder sometimes why Donna Anna is holding him off and off and off and off, even though she's been raped, I think. And it's outrageous. There is something in her that's yearning for this terrible male thing. Anyway, but in the middle, the perfect humane middle place is Donna Elvira, who is enraged at the man who's taken her heart and her innocence. And yet, even in this song where she's saying she'd tear his heart out, she's actually saying, I'll tear his heart out if he doesn't come back to me. And that equivocation, it's beautiful in the words and in the drama, and it seems to be there somehow in the music, which is yielding and assertive both at once.
It's the terzetto from Act One.
Oh,
And so the still world turns again.
Absolutely.
The terzetto from Don Giovanni, Act 1 by Mozart, Kyrie Kanoa sang Donna Elvira, Ruggero Raimondi, Don Giovanni, and José Van Damme, Leporello, with the orchestra of the Paris Opera, conducted by Lorin Marzal. I suppose, like many music lovers, and particularly those who love chamber music, Tessa Hadley, you're an aficionado of the Beethoven quartets, and particularly the late ones.
I really wouldn't call myself an aficionado, but I've listened to them since I was a teenager. Somebody gave me the Amadeus playing them on a great big box set of vinyl, and I had a little wooden black box record player, and I used to sit in the dark. I had to put it on in the light and then turn the light off, and I used to sit as a teenager sort of taking them in. So yes, the Amadeus formed the way I hear them, and other people's playing will sounds odd to me. And yes, extraordinary, superb pieces of the project, I suppose, that we heard Strauss reaching after the dying strains of, that ambition for music, that it have an intellectual complexity that, in a way, Beethoven wills into being and then embodies so marvellously. Although, actually, I've not chosen one of the great high points of intellectual complexity exactly. I've chosen the other thing he does, which is no less, which is where the music just leaps and dances. And it's funny, I listened to that Mozart just there and I was thinking how rhythmically exciting it is. All those holes in the music where your breath seems to be sucked away and then it starts again. And in this little Beethoven presto movement, I don't know what's hastening the music along, but you actually biologically seem to respond to that. And you feel this hurrying urgency as you listen that's skipping ahead of you. It seems connected to what happens with pop music, where you're sitting at the edge of the dance floor and something starts up and your body wants to dance. And that seems to happen with the Beethoven here. Thank you.
You know, contemporary dancers now can do this wonderful thing of running towards wall and then seemingly to run up it before turning back. And it's a bit like that.
It is like that.
Constantly running up the wall.
Yes.
We heard the presto from Beethoven's String Quartet in B-flat, Opus 130, played by the Amadeus Quartet. We're going to play you out on your final choice, Tessa Hadley, and I think Ellington, well, probably because of your father, was surrounded you when you were young.
Yes, as I say, jazz feels to me like coming home, so I have to finish with this. And Ellington, above all, probably my dad's greatest hero. I remember the day Ellington died, but I've never seen my dad quite... the passing of something enormous. And this is one of my favourite. It's from Money Jungle, a wonderful album where the great Ellington meets and plays with one of his great heirs, Charlie Mingus on the bass, who makes the bass sound not like part of a rhythm section, but like some eloquent, melodic thing. And again, this lovely piece that I've chosen, it's the seductions of the oldest song. These two utterly sophisticated jazz musicians who've taken jazz everywhere and anywhere, but they come back to playing a blues, and that mix of the ground of music with the extremes of what's rich and what's innovative, that's sort of perfection.
And with Max Roach playing the drums, Backward Country Boy Blues from the album Money Jungle by Duke Ellington. And on that note, Tessa Hadley, may I say thank you very much.
Thank you.
Duke Ellington's Backward Country Boy Blues from the album Money Jungle. It was Tessa Hadley's final choice this week, and she was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the food writer and critic Matthew Fort. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall. Well, a very good afternoon to you. Welcome along to the afternoon from me, Ian Skelly, here to guide you through the programmes, which continue in just a moment with a visit to Italy in 1706 alongside Handel, a young Handel, on his very first visit to the country, inspiring from him more than 80 cantatas. Catherine Bott uncovers the story in the Early Music Show. That's after a summary of the news this lunchtime. The time is 1 o'clock. It's read by John Shea.
At least 6 people have died and around 50 people have been injured after a powerful earthquake in northern Italy. It's the worst tremor felt in the country since the L'Aquila earthquake 3 years ago. There was severe damage to historic buildings over a wide area. Several church towers collapsed and a 14th century castle has been declared unsafe. The Shadow Chancellor, Ed Balls, has said David Cameron is looking increasingly isolated in Europe and that the American and French presidents recognise the need for a jobs and growth plan. Mr. Balls said Germany would have to be persuaded that the crisis in the Eurozone was a catastrophe for Britain and the rest of the world. But the Justice Secretary, Ken Clark, said Labour's policy involved borrowing more money, which he described as absolutely ludicrous. NATO leaders are in Chicago for a summit expected to be dominated by the withdrawal from Afghanistan. The alliance is putting pressure on members to guarantee an orderly pullout rather than a rush to exit. The handover of security to the Afghans is due to be completed by the end of 2014. Scotland Yard has confirmed that the senior officer heading the police investigation into phone hacking is to retire after the Olympic Games. Deputy Assistant Commissioner Sue Akers has served on the force for more than 30 years. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, is due to begin a visit to Zimbabwe today at the invitation of the government. She'll meet President Robert Mugabe and is also scheduled to hold talks with human rights groups during her five-day trip. A memorial dedicated to the 255 British service personnel who died during the Falklands War has been unveiled at the National Arboretum in Staffordshire. The service, held 30 years after British forces prepared to land at San Carlos, was attended by more than 600 veterans and their families. The memorial is a partial replica of the cemetery in San Carlos and is made with stones brought over from the islands. And the weather. It'll be mainly dry with some warm sunny spells, the best of these in the north and west. There's a chance of showers in parts of the south. That's the news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 3 minutes past one.
John, thank you. In an hour from now, music by Sibelius, played by the BBC Symphony Orchestra in our Sunday concert. They've come to the end of their Sibelius season. They chose to end it earlier this month with a performance of Sibelius's first symphony. You can also hear a brand new trombone concerto and music from a witty ballet by Shostakovich, The Bolt. Our Sunday concert is at 2 this afternoon. But next, let's join Catherine Bott for the Early Music Show.
Handel is not a mere composer in England. He is an institution. Critic, dramatist and pioneer of the soundbite, George Bernard Shaw, writing more than 100 years ago. And his words ring true today. Handel and his music are tightly woven into so many facets of English life, from coronations to the aria Lascia che pianga being used in ads by a certain London department store at sale time. And no, you really don't want that mournful plea for release sung at your wedding, trust me. It's easy to forget that before Handel took London by storm, he learned his craft in Halle, Hamburg and Rome. He first went to Italy in 1706, aged 21, and over the next 4 years he was given encouragement, valuable introductions, money and commissions by leading patrons of the arts, Cardinals Ottoboni and Pamphili, and Prince Ruspoli, who employed him as a household musician. He mingled with the great singers of the day, some of whom would later work for him in London, and he wrote, as his first biographer John Mannering said, an abundance of music, and some in almost every species of composition. While he found his feet as an opera composer, Handel honed his innate dramatic instincts by writing chamber cantatas for solo voice, with a range of accompaniment from simple basso continuo to full orchestra. These aren't mere apprentice pieces. They're wonderfully expressive and a joy and a challenge to sing. In today's programme, we're featuring three of them. Let's start quite simply with the cantata Figlio d'Alte Speranze, Son of High Hopes. It's scored for soprano, violins in unison and continuo, and tells its little story in three pairs of recitatives and arias. Abdalonimos, a poor descendant of the royal house of Sidon, is forced to work as a humble gardener. He is contented, though, knowing the dark side of the power which he must one day assume. In this performance, recorded last February at the Turner Sims Hall at the University of Southampton, the singer is Roberta Invernizzi, and the violinists and continuo players of the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment are directed from the violin by Matthew Truscott. Lo spirito suo godè tra disastri.